I wanted to ask you about these old-time musicians and storytellers. That wasn't a specific part of your program, but it sounds like they were surfacing too along the way.
Well, when were you the artist in residence?
I came here in 78. But I guess Woody Simmons had probably been active well before then, hadn't he?
Well, Woody didn't really get involved with the Senior Center program directly. We were aware of him, but at that time he was doing an awful lot of traveling himself. He just really wasn't available. And my philosophy about the Senior Center program was, if people are retired and have a full life, then they really don't need us, but we hope we're here when they do. And I don't think Woody ever has. But I'm aware that there was a Hammonds family up in Huttonsville, and I think was it Jerry Milnes and you?
Jerry first. Well, Jerry was living up in there.
And he found the Hammonds. And then we knew them through the Senior Center outpost in Huttonsville. And I think they're related to the Hammonds family, whose recordings are in the Smithsonian, right?
First cousin.
But I thought you were involved in that, too.
Well, I was, but Jerry was...
He found them.
Introduced me to them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Jerry was one who would come and perform. You did, and not only when you were with the school system, but also when you became attached to Augusta. I can't recall any names of any other people who provided oral histories. But as I say, my connection really was initially and then on the periphery with in the ways that I mentioned. Mm.
Tell me your favorite Olive Goodwin story.
Well, let me see. I just think of Olive as just one of the best Joes. She just was always willing to go the extra mile to help people. She would just work and work and work. And when she was teaching at the Senior Center, she also had a class, this was later on too, an adult education class developed in weaving over the First Ward School, which had been closed, and they let her use the basement. Olive and I talked about the possibility of getting looms out into the county, because there were some people up the valley who had started weaving when she did, back in the days of the homestead, which Eleanor Roosevelt started, and Olive's family was one of the original families in to move into one of those houses. And then they had the cottage industries, and that's where Olive learned how to weave.
Teachers
they brought in.
They were
the
Danish,
government did. That could be. I'm not acquainted with that information. So she managed to get some money. Ooh, I can't remember where that money came from. It was $500 or so, and we bought two portable looms. And they were used, but that particular idea didn't ever quite develop the way we thought it would. We thought maybe we could set things up in the old school at Mingo and have some weaving.
Sort of recreate the homestead?
Well, no, nothing that ambitious, but... When people have reached senior citizen age, they don't exactly start in on a craft and become expert, but they can learn enough to give themselves some pleasure, and in some cases they learn enough to produce and earn a little money. That's another thing that was kind of disappointing to me. I thought that people who were retired would just jump at the chance to do all these wonderful things. But if you haven't been craft-oriented early on, it doesn't always take.
Hard to switch tracks, I
think. But I guess. Mm-hmm. And you haven't developed the skill you have to have in manipulating your fingers. And so you reach 75 and you want to start to weave.
You have to be pretty nimble, don't you?
You have to get coordinated, I'll say.
But all of them never had any shortage of students, did they?
Oh, no, no. Not that I know of, ever. And the friends she has in this community are legion. And she was instrumental in getting that Mountain Weavers Guild started locally, too. And that has steadily progressed. I think, well, she's going to be here. She can tell you about that. According to what she was quoted as having said in the paper, the quotation in the paper, she is very eager to come.
Great.
Yeah, she's not well in a retirement home, convalescent hospital arrangement. I'm glad she's going to be here.
Yeah, I'm glad you were here today.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks. Very
nice. I'm sitting here with Kate Long, Freda Epstein, and Scotty Wiest.
85 was the flood, and so I had taken up with 85. Him 2 years before. So 83. It was 83.
Yeah. Okay, that's how you.
And Flawn Williams is just.
By the way, we were talking Alexander Workshop. Freda brought somebody into Elkins and did one.
That's right.
Tell me about
yep,
it.
That's right. Well, yep. Uh-huh.
Tell me about your Alexander workshop.
About my that particular workshop was just bringing my friend Bruce Furtman into town here to get all my West Virginia friends riled up about the Alexander technique so that it could, I don't know, spur me onward and forward and further. I don't know. What do you say about it? Tell me what to say, Michael.
Well, if you don't want to talk about that, then tell me when you first came to Elkins. Tell me about your first impressions of Augusta.
Has taken over the conversation.
That's right. And high time. Can you say, my name is Sheila?
My name is Sheila Amorese Rice.
All right.
Hi.
And how are you?
Okay.
An old Augusta face. We
yes.
all know and love. Tell us about your early years growing up around here.
About my early years of growing up around Elkins?
Yeah.
Oh, well, Elkins was a small town at one point. We knew, basically everyone knew each other in the town. We could sit on the street corners and everything was pretty quiet. Mm-hmm. Not like it is now. Yeah. Elkins is sort of bustling compared to what it used to be.
You went to school here?
Yes, went to school here. Except for about 6 years, my dad moved to Parsons for a while. So we went to, I went to high school in Parsons, so came back after I graduated and came back to Elkins. And have been
as a college student for a while?
No. Well, after I got married, I went to college, but no. Just stayed here.
What was your first sense of Augusta?
Well, I guess I saw it. They did a mailing, and my first impression was the pottery in the brochure that I liked. This was when it first originated. I guess I got the brochures and felt like it was a real neat thing, but I didn't really know what it was all about other than I liked what I saw in the brochure.
What was it that appealed to you about?
Well, I like preserving. I like my family, I like my heritage, and Augusta's always been something that I thought did just what I like. They want to preserve their arts and crafts and the family sense. That appealed to me. Yeah.
And were there some of these crafts or some? Tell me about a little bit about your family's heritage and what it was that sort of rang a bell for you.
Well, my family were all fiddle players. all the photos of even 100 years ago, they always had their fiddles. And my grandmother was a midwife. My great-grandmother was a midwife, and my grandmother was a midwife. So things like that, sort of traditional and passing things on because they'd worked with the old doctors. My grandmother worked with Squire Bosworth, who is pretty well known throughout the county. And I just liked what I saw.
Had you heard of other preservation efforts like the Foxfire Project, or were you aware of any of those other things?
Not until I knew about Augusta, and that sort of turned me on to other aspects of the heritages, heritage arts.
So you saw the first brochure, and then what?
Started snooping around to see what else I was doing. I eventually started going to concerts and going to the Ice House, touring the college a little bit. But it wasn't on the scale, of course, that it is now. There was few people, and you had to look to find a class, truthfully, because it wasn't that big. You found more evening events than you did classes because they were so small and dispersed. And then I guess I heard of a job opening at Augusta as a secretarial job, and I applied and got it in 78. And I guess I've been here off and on since. They can't get rid of me. I worked for the Arts Council at first. It wasn't part of the D&E College as it is now. The Arts Council sponsored it. It was through endowments and the Arts Council, and I worked for 2 years through that, and financially it just didn't make it through the Arts Council. It needed the funding from D&E, and there was a six-month period of that. We really didn't know if it was even going to continue because it was in the red so bad. So there was no job, just on a waiting list, and when Gordon Hermanson decided to put Augusta under his wing, he hired Margo, and then they called me and asked me if I'd take the job because they wanted somebody from the old staff that knew sort of what was going on. And Margo and I ran it for a year by ourselves, and then Doug Hill came on. So it was quite an experience those first couple years doing what we did. And we lived here on campus and did everything that there's 40 dozen people doing now, but we had a great time.
Well, tell me more about the college's acquisition of Augusta.
Well, all I know there was, I knew that Augusta had financially came up very big in the red, and the Arts Council really couldn't take it out. There was meetings right and left with the Arts Council and what they were going to do, and they were really, the leaders of the Arts Council were just saying, we were not going to deal with it anymore, we can't fund it, and basically told us our jobs were finished. But then I'd heard a rumor through town that D&E might take us under their wings, and then we went to a meeting, I forget the doctor's wife's name, and Ellie Lesser was there, and we went to a meeting, and they told us that basically the college was going to take us over, and we still didn't know if we were going to be hired. I knew the director wouldn't be hired, and Mike Mazzolini and I didn't know for sure, so Mike, I guess, went ahead and got another job, but I sort of waited. I wanted to work at Augusta, so I held out a little bit longer. And I was able to do it, so that was better. Mike had, he couldn't wait, but we had other incomes, so I just waited until they called me, and it was a welcomed call.
That's great. Great story. Tell me some of the early people you remember associated with the program.
I remember Michael Klein, of course. And
no, I'm talking about earlier than that.
Earlier than that? Oh, I remember John McCutcheon was always part of us, and
Was he a little hard to manage sometimes, John?
Oh, John's always hard to manage, but, if you smile big enough at him, you can pretty well get what you want. of course, Jerry Mills was involved in those early years, and Olive Goodwin, and Bill Cook, who's no longer, he's no longer teaching here, but Pottery. It was Duke Mesnikowski, I think, even from the beginning. It's been so long. Tubby Fitz Randolph was a good part of us, wood carving. Rachel Nash Law was part of the early years. Of course, Marion Harless taught herbs from the time she quit directing. Susan Elkin. There was just a lot of instructors. We kept instructors, you know, as long as they really wanted to do the class and their class was going well, they kept coming back until they decided to retire on their own. So it's been a lot of them, though.
Tell me about the first summer that you and Margo worked together.
Oh, that was sort of...
you didn't have much time to prepare the thing, did you?
No, we didn't, but Margo is... you know, she's a great artist, so that's why the program has evolved like it has, because I think that being an artist, she's not afraid to gamble. She's also a great gambler, because she's gambled on a lot of classes that I was saying, no, Margo, won't do it, and they did do it, and this is where we are today. And I think where we are today is just because of Margo's dreams. And the college is funding a good bit, and giving us some access to the college has helped a whole lot. And providing offices, but the early days was fewer classes, but Margo made arrangements with each person so we come out in the black. She had a minimum maximum and she stayed right within that. And the very first year we came out in the black, which was wonderful. Not afraid to take a little chance, but she made sure that she had been around Augusta. She had made the banners the year before, so she knew what was going on. She knew who the instructors was, and whenever they told her that she was going to be director, she moved right along and started making calls in a very short order and made her contacts and got her instructors. She'd also worked with Informal Skills here at the college, so she was basically aware of how to contact the instructor and how to go about putting the program together. So, but we didn't expect what we did expect all of a sudden, you know, before we'd had a little help, and there was of course problems, but everybody sort of smiled and went on with us because they knew it was the first year and we were going to make it. And everybody, all the participants basically knew what had happened, and they were willing to give along with us to get the program going again. So we had a great time.
So it was sacrifices and concessions that the staff made too.
Yeah, and I think some of the participants did. Whenever they knew something wasn't going just right, I think they understood enough to know that, you know, too many complaints could put Augusta back where it was the previous year. And so I think everybody sort of had an in general feeling about, you know, trying to keep this together and working it out, and it did.
Well, a lot of it was due to your long hours and devotion. There's no fooling about that.
Yeah, I've had a great time.
Anything else that you can
No, I promised Margo I wouldn't tell some of the stories, so I know. Those are probably things that we need to keep in our own little heads. But
you'll carry those to the next world.
Yeah, we'll carry those along. We'll pass those along to the next generations.
Well, great talking with you. Thanks.
Nice talking to you.
Would you please say my name is Margo Blevin?
My name is Margo Blevin.
Okay. And we've just been talking to Sheila about her term of duty with the Arts Council and then the transition. And I guess that's... But you have much earlier recollections of Augusta.
Well, my first involvement with Augusta was in 1979 and 80 when I served as a volunteer. And actually, I would say I was contracted but paid a very, very tiny little amount of money. So it was really partially a volunteer position. And I was directing the craft fair and a substantial part of the Augusta Festival. Now, up until that time, the Augusta Festival was a one-day festival that was held in the craft room at the college. And Marion Harless was director, and she had this vision of taking the Augusta Festival downtown so that it would be more visible to people who were, for various reasons, not comfortable coming up to the college campus. So I helped her organize that. We got the Y to allow us to use their space, and the American Legion Hall, and we got the police to barricade all of, is that First Street? And that was the start of the festival down in the park, downtown, and then later we took it in here into the park. But the I made banners, I made signs, I found craft people and invited them, got the tables set up, brought the tables back in, picked up the garbage, set up the displays, stood there with a magic marker and some poster board, right, making signs to tell people where the bathrooms were. Some things haven't changed. I did that today, too. But that was it. And I was also doing some freelancing, making posters for Augusta in return for concert tickets. I had never actually taken an Augusta class. And at the time that the Augusta was being sponsored by the Creative Arts Council, their financing was very shaky because the tuition was very low. And it wasn't really covering enough to pay full-time staff. So the full-time staff, which consisted of a director and a PR person and a secretary, those salaries were being paid out of CETA funds. When CETA funds dried up, and immediately Augusta went bankrupt. There was no money to pay the staff. And this was at the end of the summer of 1980. So between the summer of 1980 and January of 1981, there was a lot of wringing of hands and wondering what to do. The Arts Council, of course, couldn't take responsibility for financial backing. And they approached Gordon Hermanson, the president of D&E College, and he said immediately it was part of his vision that this would come back to D&E where it had originally started. So he was very happy about taking it over as the ownership of the program, so to speak. And at the time, I was doing a part-time job as craft coordinator for the college. And since Augusta was largely, almost entirely, a craft program, that time I was hired. I was asked to be director as a part-time job. It was assumed that I was going to continue to be craft coordinator at the college and work on Augusta in my spare time. So I thought about it, and what I had always heard about Augusta, never having gotten involved very much, I had always heard that everybody who was involved with it was always mad at everybody else. And I didn't want people to be mad at me. So I said, no, I didn't want to do it. But several people prevailed on me to change my mind. Truett Gilbreth pushed me into it, and Paul Reisler and several other people said, we know you can do it. And there's a way to do it that people aren't mad at everybody, and you can figure out how to do that. So I thought, well, I certainly need a job. I'll try to do it. Well, of course, the other thing that I said was I would take the job on condition that Sheila Amorese would come to work for me as my secretary. So when Sheila said that she would do it, I took the job as director. And this was in February of 1981 that they approached me, and there had been no publicity. No one had been hired. There had been no grants applied for, no grant reports on the previous grants. There had been a grant applied for, I'm sorry, there was one from the state, and that was it. And there we were in February. I told them I would give them my answer in March. And between February and March, I had already, you know, done a lot of research and figured out a lot of the things I was doing and started working on it, which sort of has been par for the course with Augusta. You do a lot of things that are above and beyond what you have to do because it's such an adventure. And you have a commitment to what we're doing. Everybody on the staff does that. So I threw together a flyer, I threw together a staff, and I threw together a poster, and we didn't have a mailing list. There was no mailing list. There was nothing. There were some index cards with some names, and that was it. I called June Apple, which I had never heard of. I knew nothing about this field. Through just picking people's brains, asking John McCutcheon, asking Paul Reisler, asking Bob Dalsimer, people like that who I vaguely knew and trusted just by instinct, I found out that June Apple had this wonderful mailing list, and I called them up, told them my dilemma, and they sent me labels with the names of 4,000 people who might be interested in this program. And then I looked at the books and I said, okay, now how would McDonald's do this? You know, in order to be able to keep the price of their hamburger down, they sell more hamburgers than anybody else, right? So I said, we don't have enough classes to pay for these staff people. I have to raise my own salary by the end of this year and break even, or the college is not going to keep doing this. So we added about half again as many classes. And just as an experiment, although I wasn't sure it would work, I added a hammer dulcimer class because I knew that a lot of people like around Elkins liked hammer dulcimer music. I called Sam Rosetta and I said, Sam, do you think that you could teach a class in hammer dulcimer playing? He said, well, I certainly could teach it, but I don't know how many people would come for a whole week to learn how to play the hammer dulcimer. He said, how many people would you have to make it sell? And I said, well, I think we'd have to have six in order to pay your salary. He said, well, if you don't get six, I'll take less money. And we had 33 people come that first year. It was amazing. So that kind of told me that there was a need there for it. And what we've really done ever since is take the core program and add classes that I think fill a need that people have. People want to learn something, we offer it. We're not pushing something exotic on them, except once in a while for their own good.
But Sam has been one of Augusta's real strong offerings, right?
He's been a mainstay ever since, and he's really more or less coordinated our dulcimer program. I would never hire anybody without Sam Rosetta telling me this is a good people person, this person relates to people well. If he tells me that he doesn't know them personally, I have a hard time knowing whether or not they will fit in, because I know that he sees that special instinct that people have to help people and to know how to convey information to them. And that's really the crux of the success of the program, is that we hire people who are not necessarily the big stars, the big names, the big attraction, but the people who are able to communicate.
It's an interesting mix of named and unnamed.
Yeah. Now, the craft program in the early days, before I came on the scene, was the largest focus of Augusta by far, and we have not in any way cut back on it. We have increased the number of craft classes, but the thing that has grown phenomenally are the number of music and dance classes. That's been an enormous curve growth and a growth curve, and we've probably come as far as we can in adding those classes, and just have to kind of rotate new ones in and old ones out.
If Sam Rosetta was a giant of an instructor, certainly for music, then Olive Goodwin certainly took that.
Yes, I was very lucky because I came in on the tail end of an era where we had a program that artistically was an enormous success. There has never been any question about that. The only reason it was not a success financially was that the prices were so low, and there wasn't a possibility, there was no financial backing to give it a foothold where you could have the same staff for several years in a row. Now, the problem was that CETA funds were paying for the director. And CETA funds are only allowed to be paid to somebody for a maximum of 18 months. And you had to hire a director who had been out of work for at least 15 months. It was very specific.
From the county where the funds were?
Not necessarily, but it happened that it was that. And I think actually from the state. It had to be from the same state. And it's amazing that the competent people that they were able to find who fit that bill. And the only problem is that the turnover was just too rapid for anybody to do any long-range planning. You had one person hiring the staff in 1 year, And then they would leave just before the program started, and somebody else was hired to come in and work with that staff. And then 18 months later, the same thing happened again. So there was no continuity. And that was the only thing lacking. The program, as conceived by Margaret Godden and Dale Wilson, was amazingly intact as it is today. I mean, they thought of every aspect of it. And the only part of it that really they did not foresee was the intensity of the people coming here, the commitment, because I have some of their early memos in which they describe, they make statements like, well, now we have to think of field trips for people to come to go in their spare time, because otherwise they'll be bored.